Production. Recorded live.
Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Howdy, everyone. Hope you're all doing well. My name is Lynn, and I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone. And I'd like to say hello to my co-hosts, Bobby Neer and Robert. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Well, today we're going to discuss an episode called The Trouble with Templeton. And I'll turn it over to Robert for the opening clip.
And now, Mr. Serling.
An attractive and rather imposing room lived in by a man named Templeton. And like most rooms, suggestive really of only a part of the man, the outside part. Our story takes off from here. Mr. Brian Ahern lends us his considerable talents in a script by E. Jack Newman called The Trouble with Templeton. It can best be described as poignant, provocative, and a highly diverting trip into the Twilight Zone.
Well, Lynn, I hope you agree with that. Is it provocative?
It's not exactly the word I'd use. Thanks, Robert. Well, before I begin, I'd like to welcome guest number 5, and I'd like to welcome Dave, our good friend from England. Hello, folks.
Cheers.
Okay, The Trouble with Templeton portrays a man named Booth Templeton. He's an aging actor who may have enjoyed some notoriety in his prime, but he's now struggling to simply maintain his dignity and his much too young wife. Seeing his current wife blatantly and indiscreetly flirting with a much younger man, he reminisces and longs for the days when he was happy with his first wife, Laura, who died at a very early age. He then leaves to rehearse for a new play directed by a very young director. Now, taken aback by this young whippersnapper's harsh words to him for being a few minutes late to rehearsal, Booth runs out of the theater and finds himself back in time to 1927, when he was a real star on the stage. A man approaches him to say that his wife, Laura, is waiting for him at the local speakeasy. He anxiously goes to meet her, only to find that she's not the woman he remembers. She's flamboyant, boisterous, and shows more interest in Booth's best friend, Barney, than in him. He tries to talk some sense into her and wants her to leave with him. She gets up to dance, and Booth grabs her, breaking her pearl necklace, at which point she screams, "Why don't you go back where you came from? We don't want you here." So Booth is devastated, and he leaves and goes back to the present. He walks into the theater that he ran from, and he pulls a script out of his pocket that's titled, "What to Do When Booth Comes Back." And he realizes that Laura and the people from his past were all staging a play and acting for his benefit so that he'd go back to the present and realize that he needs to live for the present and leave the past in the past. Then he confronts the young director and lets him know that he is too much of a consummate professional to be treated like a dog by a kid more than half his age. The kid is shocked, and he understands, and he respects Booth's authority. And that is the end of the story. Well, I really didn't enjoy this episode. Here's a guy who marries a woman way too young for him and possibly a gold digger, and then despairs over the fact that she may not be totally faithful to him. Well, gee, you think so? Then he longs to be with his first wife again and thinks he can actually go back just as he is and start the relationship again where he left off. Now, maybe he didn't realize that he looked older to her, but once she brought it to his attention, he still expected her to succumb to him. The ending bothered me because my feeling is that he should have stood up to the arrogant young director right from the start. The guy was disrespectful to Booth, and he ran out of the theater like a scared rabbit. Overall, I was not happy with this episode at all. Now, there's one notable moment in it, though. If you look closely, when Laura gets up to dance and Booth grabs her, he breaks her pearl necklace in two. A couple of shots later, the necklace is in one piece again. That's a little oversight by the film editors, but one of those little things that most people don't notice. And you know, Brian Ahern, he was okay with that role. I mean, he was good for that role. You know, he basically was perfect for the part. Handsome, you know, distinguished older actor, you know, with a young wife. You know, he was good for the part. And Pippa Scott, well, you know, she was fine for that role. I'm sure she was supposed to overact, because when she got up on that dance floor and started flailing around, it was that flapper dance, like some kind of a lunatic on the dance floor. She looked like she was having an epileptic seizure. That's what she looked like to me. But, you know, I wanted to smack her when she got up to start dancing. But, you know,
now, Lynn, you're just jealous because you can't do that.
That's true. I can't dance like I was very, very jealous of her.
I'm married to her. Believe me, she does it all the time.
But anyway, I gave this episode a lousy zero rating. It just didn't do it for me, you know, for all the reasons that I stated. So I'm going to turn this over now to Robert.
Oh, thank you, Lynn. Yeah, I think the problem with this story is it falls directly on the writer. I kind of understand where he was going with this, this E. Jack Newman. He kind of started something, I felt, and didn't finish it. But, of course, here again we talk about you only have 25 minutes to do a Twilight Zone episode. But I'm going the opposite end of the scale here. I kind of gave it a 2.5, but kind of a revision on the score because, you know, I pretty much understand that it's time travel in this episode. I mean, with this, there's two schools of thought. It could be either time travel, or it could be all in his mind, maybe going through being in 1927, even though the character in the story believes, and he even explains it when he goes to the speakeasy to meet his wife, Laura. They're there having dinner, and runs into his writer friend there, too. And he, you know, tries to explain it to her that, you know, well, I traveled back in time to see you and all this stuff. But I think the story is about a man that is devastated and has to be rebuilt. And in order to be rebuilt, he has to go back to the past. A lot of things tell us that we should look towards the future and not look back on the past. But sometimes, you know, we try to look for that lost youth. And maybe that's what he was trying to do with this. I thought it was interesting that we get what we call a paradox. And what a paradox is, you know, there's different kinds of paradoxes, but this one is where you go back and into your past and sometimes run into yourself. And you try not to come in contact with yourself, because if you do, then it can cause destruction. Of course, you know, you watch various shows that where they show something like that. In this one, and I think this is where the writer fails, that he doesn't see himself. It would have been interesting to have a younger version of himself, maybe to you know, see what it was like, and, you know, maybe think to himself, well, I can't relive the past. You know, I need to go on with my future and you know, go back from the 27 back to his present day. Sometimes the present day just don't have a part in the past, and, you know, the past is the past, and we need to look forward. And I think he realized that. The thing also, too, is when coming back into the past, he has the script of the whole incident that happened. If we go down with the school thought of, you know, all in his mind, was it him that actually wrote the script and had it in his pocket and was just reliving what was going on from that in his mind? Or did he truly, when he got frustrated and mad trying to explain himself, grabbing the script and going back to today? Like I said, this seems to be like, you know, a three-quarter script, but it's still missing a quarter of it. So this one I squarely blame on the writer himself for, you know, not taking this idea and actually bring it to its fourth fruitation.
Just bringing it a step further.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I think Rod seen what he was doing as well. I don't know if he gives suggestions. I imagine he did give suggestions to his writers, and or if he had an idea, or he might just let them, you know, do with themselves, you know, write the script, look over and set it up for the show. But, you know, the writer really needed help with the script and, you know, to bring it forward. But Unfortunately, yeah. I mean, you know, I like the concept of it. I like the time travel. I'm going down that road, and I, you know, I accept that. But I think the added addition to it, if they would have added a younger self in there where he goes back and does, I think that would have helped the story a lot better. I mean, this one moves along a lot better than last one that we reviewed, which was Lateness of the Hour, which was just so and tedious and dull and boring. But
yeah.
This one had a little bit more to it. And he knew what was going on with his new wife, and you know, he knew she was playing around. And then the thing that I really wasn't too crazy about was the butler. I mean, you know, the butler was acting more like his friend or psychiatrist more than a butler. You know, it seemed, oh, it'll get better, you're okay, you know, being the sympathetic arm for Booth there. And you know, hey, just give me my clothes and a drink and I'm ready to go, I would have told that butler. So I don't want to hear your psychobabble, you know, analytical explanation of why I'm feeling so down, you know. But
he was probably fooling around with his wife, too.
Well, that's what a pool's there for. So you can, you know, when you're not home, you can bring the pool boy over to clean the pool for you. What do you think pool boys are for? You think they just clean your pool? Yeah, there was a couple, since we're going with a paradox theme, a couple of clips I brought with me. One is from Doctor Who, the new series from 2005. The episode was called Father's Day. In this, we learn about Rose's father, what happened to him, how he passed away, and about, you know, her going back on a whim with the doctor and try to save her father with some very dire, you know, coincidence. And this is a scene where they go back to her father's apartment where she actually changed the time stream. And this is her and the doctor with her father.
Where else would you put the milk? Mind you, there's always a window seal outside. I always thought if someone invented a window seal with special compartments, you know, one for milk, one for yogurt, I'd get a lot of money out of that. Tell it to students and things. I should write that down. Anyway, never mind that. Excuse me for a minute. I've got to change.
All the stuff Mum kept. His stuff. She kept it all packed away in boxes in the cupboard. She used to show me when she'd had a bit to drink. There it is. On display. But it should be. Third prize at the bowling. Those two got to go to Didcot. Health drinks. Tonics, Mum used to call them. He made his money selling this biotech stuff. He had all sorts of jobs. He was so clever. Solar power. Mum said he was going to do this. Now he can. Okay, look, I'll tell him you're not my boyfriend.
When we met, I said, travel with me in space. You said no. Then I said, time machine.
It wasn't some big plan. I just saw it happening, and I thought, I can stop it.
I did it again. I picked another stupid ape. I should have known. It's not about showing you the universe. It never is. It's about the universe doing something for you.
So it's okay when you go to other times and you save people's lives, but not when it's me saving my dad.
I know what I'm doing. You don't. Two sets of us being there made that a vulnerable point.
He's alive!
My entire planet died. My whole family. Do you think it never occurred to me to go back and save them?
But it's not like I've changed history. Not much. I mean, he's never going to be a world leader. He's not going to start World War III or anything.
Rose, there's a man alive in the world who wasn't alive before. An ordinary man. That's the most important thing in creation. The whole world's different because he's alive.
What, was your husband dead?
I'm not saying
no,
that.
No, I get it. For once, you're not the most important man in my life.
Let's see how you get on without me, then. Give me the key. The TARDIS key. I'm so insignificant. Give it me back.
All right, then I will.
Well, you got what you wanted, so that's goodbye, then.
You don't scare me!
And with this, we get the classic paradox where, unfortunately, with this episode, a sacrifice has to be made again to right the time back on the original course, but this was one of my favorite. The Ninth Doctor was played by Christopher Eccleston. First year that they brought Doctor Who back, which, you know, I still get tears. It's a very emotional episode to watch, and it's one that you can't really watch all the time because of that. So going from that to Star Trek Next Generation, of course, one of my favorite characters was Q. And there was towards the end of the last season, Next Generation, an episode called Tapestry. And with this one, Jean-Luc Picard is on a away mission, and he's injured, close to dying. And then he gets the confrontation of Q in a possible afterlife.
Welcome to the afterlife, Jean-Luc. You're dead.
Q, what is going on?
I told you. You're dead. This is the afterlife. And I'm God.
You are not God!
Blasphemy. You're lucky I don't cast you out or smite you or something. The bottom line is, your life ended about 5 minutes ago under the inept ministrations of Dr. Beverly Crusher.
No. I am not dead. Because I refuse to believe that the afterlife is run by you. The universe is not so badly designed.
Have a good laugh now, Q. Does it amuse you to think of me living out the rest of my life as a dreary man in a tedious job?
I gave you something most mortals never experience. A second chance at life. And now all you can do is complain?
I can't live out my days as that person. That man is bereft of passion and imagination. That is not who I am.
Au contraire, he's the person you wanted to be. One who was less arrogant and undisciplined in his youth. One who was less like me. The Jean-Luc Picard you wanted to be, the one who did not fight the Nausicaan, had quite a different career from the one you remember. That Picard never had a brush with death, never came face to face with his own mortality, never realized how fragile life is or how important each moment must be. So his life never came into focus. He drifted through much of his career, with no plan or agenda, going from one assignment to the next, never seizing the opportunities that presented themselves. He never led the away team on Millika 3 to save the ambassador. Or take charge of the Stargazer's bridge when its captain was killed. And no one ever offered him a command. He learned to play it safe. And he never, ever got noticed by anyone.
You're right, Q. You gave me the chance to change, and I took the opportunity. But I admit now, it was a mistake.
Are you asking me for something, Jean-Luc?
Give me a chance to put things back the way they were before.
Before you died in sickbay. Is that what you want?
I would rather die as the man I was than live the life I just saw.
And with this one, Patrick Stewart, wonderful actor, was great in the 7 years of the series, plus into the movies themselves. But one of my favorite from season 7 of Next Generation. And here is another paradox where Jean-Luc Picard is given the opportunity to go back to change his life. But once he did, he found out that it wasn't what he wanted. He was always known as the adventurer type person, but, you know, playing it safe just didn't get him where he was. So
you mentioned this in your review, didn't you, Robert?
Yeah, both of these were mentioned in my review. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Tapestry shows that, you know, you pick a string, and if you pull on that string too much, then your life or even the universe itself can come apart as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand you're not liking this, but we don't have, back then in the 50s and 60s, examples where we can go upon, as we do today, to where, and as I explained in past episodes, that a lot of these people that were in production and producers and actors and stuff used the Twilight Zone as kind of a building block for what they do today. And, you know, it's kind of nice to be able to reflect back upon the past to see what helped create the future with this story.
That's
so
true.
I give this a 2.5 out of 5, and I'll go ahead and pass this on to Bobby. Sorry
right,
it takes so long there, Bobby.
Okay. Thanks very much. I really can't disagree with Lynn's summary. I pretty much agree with every word of it. We have here another rather tedious time travel story, at least on a limited scale. And that theme, while usually interesting, always ends the same way. The lead character usually attempts to change either world history or his own, and it never, ever works out. So you got to wonder why we even bother. Of course, most time travelers are attempting to visit the past, and in this episode, Templeton simply finds himself there all of a sudden. And nothing really happens. No world history to change here, just a grown man learning a lesson he should have known all along, given his experience. And that is that you need to live in the present and make the best of it, not in the past, which is over and done with, whether you like it or not. Of course, Templeton was rather gullible here. He lived the past, should have realized that something was up when he saw his late wife as being so promiscuous, when he knew she had been nothing of the kind when he was married to her. Several people on our board, including you, Robert, have suggested it would have been a better story had Templeton confronted himself in the past, not just his wife. It's an interesting theory, but I think that would have required this to be part of the unfortunate season where the Twilight Zone went to an hour, and I wouldn't have wanted to have to sit through this for another 30 minutes.
Well, that's why I said it's pretty much the writer's fault with this situation. He didn't really.
Well, yeah, if
you
got 25 minutes, you need to know what your limitations are. So if you either start it knowing you can finish it or don't start it to begin with. Now, I checked this episode out at IMDb, where 7 people wrote reviews and gave it an average rating of 7.2 out of 10, which is really very high. There are a lot of feature films that don't get that kind of rating. One person even called it one of the very best stories of the entire series.
Oh, we heard
I have
that
no
before.
Idea what he was watching. It wasn't the story I was watching. there is a little reality to this story. As Brian Ahern, as Templeton, really was a famous stage actor back in the 20s. Exactly the time frame of this episode, before he went into films, where he eventually was nominated for an Oscar. As far as his marriage is concerned, his first marriage ended in divorce after about 6 years, but his second marriage lasted over 4 decades until he died.
He was nominated for an Oscar? He was nominated
for
an Oscar?
Yes, he was. Yeah,
really?
I didn't write down the movie it was. Yeah, he didn't win, but he was nominated. Yeah. He had a pretty extensive career for a while there. As far as marriage is concerned, his first one ended in divorce. The second one lasted 4 decades until he died in the 80s, and she outlived him by over 15 years. Penna Scott, the woman he was married to this day, she's still alive. She's in her mid-70s today. And she even guest starred on a TV series about 3 years ago, so she's still around. Brian Ahern, at least to some people, may be known better as the captain of the Titanic. Back in 1953, in the very first movie made about that shipwreck.
Wasn't that with Barbara Stanwyck?
Yeah,
I remember that
right.
One.
Right, yeah, that's the fictional one. It was followed by the one they made in England, which was a lot, you know, more almost like a documentary to deal with. This was basically just fiction dealing with characters that they made up. But it's a good movie. I've always enjoyed it. That was, of course, the first of what would turn out to be several movies in that subject, as everybody knows. And back then, he wasn't able to change anything there either. That wasn't a time travel story. He was just on the ship, and it went down anyway. And neither were the two lead characters in the old 60s TV series, The Time Tunnel, where they visited the Titanic in the pilot episode of that series. They weren't able to undo it either. So I like time travel stories, but they never go anywhere. We've got one coming up in a few months back there, which I do like, but it's the same old story, trying to change history and not being able to do it. It never, ever works out. What's done is done, and that's it. Now, this episode here just doesn't do anything. It didn't do anything for me at all, and I don't think has been pointed out here that you know enough about him to really get anything out of it. Oh, one other thing in this episode that's of some interest is that that new director that's giving him a hard time is played by Sidney Pollack.
He's a very young man.
And he eventually, of course, went on to be a very famous director. He directed one of my favorite films, Tootsie, and various other ones, too. So there's some interesting people in here.
So, Bobby, you do agree that this is a time and not of a mind and matter situation, that you believe he actually did when he came back with the script that was left back in the past?
Yeah. Do I think that he imagined the whole thing?
Or was the time travel, yeah.
No, he really was there. I mean, he's got the script in his hand. So obviously he can get it out of nowhere. But I mean, it's all about learning a lesson, and he's been around. He's not exactly a young man, so he should realize that you have to live for the present. You can't just whine about how it used to be, because all you end up with is a lot of whining about how it used to be, and it goes absolutely nowhere. So he learned the lesson, but there really wasn't anything terribly compelling in time travel stories, especially in series that deal with fantasy or the future or anything like that, are always, I mean, I don't know exactly how many Twilight Zone did. It was quite a few. And they're always interesting, but I watch them. If there was one on TV this afternoon that was new, I'd probably watch it. But you always know how they're going to end. It just doesn't, I would like a time travel story to be different, and maybe history does get changed. Although, if I remember correctly, in the movie The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, I don't know, I don't remember about the book because I read it when I was a little kid, but in the movie, he does actually go back to the future, and he decides to live there because it's better than what he has in the present. I don't know whether the book ended that way.
Right. Well, he goes back to grab books and stuff to help rebuild the civilization.
Right.
In the future.
Like, do you remember if the book? Did the book end that way? I don't really remember.
I never read the book. I seen the movie. So
I read it when I was a little kid. It's too long ago. I don't remember anymore.
I'm sorry.
But they change everything in the movies, even self by H.G. Wells. It wouldn't surprise me.
Which story is this?
The Time Machine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, with Rod Taylor. Yeah, it's a good movie. And, again, it's the same old story. He goes back and sees various things happening, but he can't do anything about it. I won't give credit to this story for taking a different drift. And instead of just having somebody go back and try to change history, you know, and maybe see his own history. But, again, you know, all they do, I'll grant it this. It's different in that, you know, the people in the past say to him, get out of here, you don't belong here. Go live your life and what's left of it, and just don't worry about what happened here. I think he was kind of nice, kind of gullible, though. Man had been around, and he knew his wife wasn't like that, so something was up. Well, he goes back to the past, she looks the same, but she is now much more promiscuous than she was before. Doesn't add up. So he kind of bought into that a little too easily. But I'll give it credit for that. Unfortunately, that's not enough to change my rating, so I'll stick with Lynn and give it a 0 rating.
Oh, you ain't going to give it a 1, Bobby, just out of...
No, I wouldn't want to wreck my reputation as a hard ass. I might as well keep it that way. So I'll stick with the 0. It almost tries reaching for a 1, but time runs out, time for commercials, and that's it, it's over with, and that's the end of it. So, I agree with you. If it had been fleshed out a little bit more, and I knew a little bit more about him, and why he wanted to go back to the past so badly, I might have seen something in it. But as it is, I'll stick with the 0. That's it for me, Lynn. That's about it.
Okay. Hey, Dave, what do you have to say?
Well, just a few things.
I'm sure you do.
I actually agreed with that last part, that not the last part on Bobby's rating, but the part about it that I didn't see it as a time travel one trying to change the past, because he doesn't change the past in any way. I'm not even sure that he actually travelled into the past anyway. First of all, I thought the main character, Brian, was brilliantly cast in this part. I thought his voice was excellent. He had that sort of gravitas that you need for that sort of Shakespearean actor who now has lost a lot of his shine. I think the start of it, the bit with where he's allowing his manservant, or whatever you want to call it, his personal aide, to sort of help him like that, is the fact that he's a man that basically is a broken, saddened man who obviously has got some sort of heart condition. He's the shadow of the man he once was. I don't think he was deceived by the second wife that he had. I think he was actually smiling inwardly at the ironic nature of it, that, you know, there's no fool like an old fool. He should have realised that when he married her, you know, that wasn't going to work out. And now he'd resigned himself to just daydreaming about times gone past. So he was a very weakened and wounded man that went to that first calling. And I'm glad that Bobby also mentioned about it being Sidney Pollack that played that part. And, of course, he would never have let such a man browbeat him in his heyday. I don't think he does go to the past. He dreams of the past, but the past comes to him, if you want to put it in any such way of that. Because he says to her, you know, I don't know where I am in time or space. And they get round quite neatly the fact that he's much older, of course, by his early wife looks at him and said, you should have taken your makeup, you're getting absent-minded, you should have taken your makeup off before you came. And remember, there's a long history in certainly in those days that, I don't know, think about people like Orson Welles playing, where even when he was in about 25, he was playing, you know, men of distinction from the big films that he made. So it wasn't unusual for a stage actor to be playing a much older person than they actually were.
Or Lon Chaney day.
Yeah,
right.
Indeed. Yeah, sure. I loved the little thing when it faded to black as he moved out. I thought that was done. I mean, I think it was a little bit over-egged, as Bobby said about, and Lynn said about the way she was behaving. In fact, one thing I had to look up was the actress who played the first wife, Pippa Scott. I'm thinking, she's only supposed to be between 18 and 24. They seem to have picked a woman in her 30s.
But she was actually 25. She was 25
years old. She was, well, 1 week. It was broadcast on the 9th of December 1960, but obviously it was made a few months before that. And she was born in November the 5th, 1935. So she was actually 24 when she filmed it. But I think all that makeup and costumes from those age, you know, made her look like a, not that 30-year-old or 35 is old for a woman, but, you know, she didn't look like, you know, a fresh young bride in that sense. I like the fact that he had the script when he came back. I also like the fact that when he's looking through the script, none of his words were in the script. The script was their script, prepared for when he came. But a little bit like, if I'll give another connection to Doctor Who, and I'm sure you'll get this a little bit anyway. Well, Robert will. I'm getting some echo from somewhere. The Blink episode where there's a conversation with the Doctor where half the conversation was written in the future, but the script gets taken back in time and the Doctor only reads his half of the script. She's having this conversation with the Doctor in the 1960s, as it happens, 1969. And this girl, Sally Sparrow, the character, can't understand how the Doctor can know what she's going to say. And he knows what she's going to say because he has the script in front of him. So,
right, her friend's brother was writing what she was saying, the responses back, and the Doctor was reading it from the past back. Yeah.
So that was the parallel I got from Doctor Who. I think it was basically the fact that, as Bobby said, it wasn't the fact that he was changing history. He was mending himself, really. And he came back to the rehearsal room and, you know, put his foot down again. And he was the man he once was. So
do you believe that this was in the mind? Or
No.
He did truly time travel?
No, I don't think he traveled. I don't think he time traveled in as much as I think that was a place out of time. Whether you call them ghosts or, you know, obviously the Twilight Zone itself, which you could argue is timeless. So I don't think it was that. And if there was another Twilight Zone that was a little bit like this, it'd be another one that you guys didn't like, and that was a nervous man in a $4 room. He'd lost his, whatever you say he's lost, his spunk. And it was the mirror that berated him and got him to, actually they swapped over. But that was the most similar of the earlier Twilight Zones that I thought reflected a little bit on this. And just goes back to Sydney Pollack as I finish. Films like Out of Africa, they shoot horses, don't they? Tootsies was mentioned. The Firm. So 3 Days of the Condor, which I love that film with Robert Redford. So lots of
that's a good films. Movie.
Yeah, yeah. So I agree with Lynn right at the beginning when she thought it was perfect for the part, and I agree with Bobby when he said that it was he that changed, not history was changed. And I thought it was pitch perfect, although it was. I can agree with the people in the room that it was a fairly lightweight story. But again, all these stories, they only last about 23 or 4 minutes by the time you've got the adverts out of them. And I'd give it a 3 out of 5. So I must be a softie.
but you're a cute softie. No, that's, you know, that's fine because there are people who liked, other people who liked it. And like Bobby said, on IMDb, it got a 7.2 rating. So you're certainly not alone in liking it. But
yeah,
you know,
it wasn't a fine episode, but I think it was well pitched. I think the actor who got the plane, Brian Ahern, or whatever he was absolutely spot on for that. He gave, as I said before, a little bit of gravitas. You felt as though he was once a great actor, and indeed in real life, he was too. And as I put in the text, he has a Hollywood Walk of Fame star.
Yeah, that's right. I saw that on the chat room there, yeah. I didn't know that.
So, Dave, what if this script was written to where he would meet himself, his younger self? Would you consider that as a time travel, or still him going through his mind meeting his younger self?
And well, I actually preferred it the way it was done because, as I say, the whole reason for this scene, this vignette part of it, was the fact that it wasn't to change history. It was him. I mean, it would have been nice if they were. He had the script, and there was version 1, version 2, version 3. You know,
then you get to the
to
parallel
do,
situation.
What to do if he says this? What to do if he says that? And they each had 3 lots of answers.
I think it would have been interesting if he had gone back and actually confronted his younger self, and maybe they were in a conflict. Yeah, you know, some kind of a conflict with the younger and the older self. I think that would have, you know, been a little bit more interesting than the way it was, or the way it is.
Mm. Yeah. I think the fact that, again, that some people mentioned that, you know, the scene with his manservant, our personal assistant, it might have seemed a little prolonged, but I think the idea there was to give the idea that, you know, this was a man who was just a shadow of his former self. And it was only because of that he was eligible to be taken to this place or time.
Well, we
can't get. I think he did better on the Titanic, frankly.
I think the kind of butler we get in this story is kind of like what we get butler-wise down the road. Like a well-known one was Mr. French in A Family Affair.
Oh yeah.
Where
yeah,
he
was more
always,
like a part of the family. Yeah, he was more like an uncle than a butler.
Yeah, he would give you know, advice to the kids and to Uncle Bill and all. So, and then, you know, we have other butlers we can talk about, like the nanny or Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Well, also 2 1/2 Men, Berta. Berta's like, you know, she's basically like a mother to them, you know. A very crass mother, but she's like a mother to them. So I also like her character, yeah. Yeah, it's not like the typical, you know, the servant that you know your place. I mean, these people are like part of the family.
I love the one, if anybody ever watched WKRP in Cincinnati, old Mama Carson's butler was hilarious. Yes, ma'am, you want me to answer that door? That old butler she had.
I remember him, but I don't remember any of the scenes. I remember he was a funny guy, though.
Yeah. Or he'll sit on the couch or drink or something, and she'll end up getting a door or something.
And then you have a whole TV show for about a butler, Benson.
Yep.
I've just been reading here about Pippa Scott. She made a movie debut in The Searchers, which seems absolutely fantastic. That was made in 1956, 4 years earlier, so she must have been aged 20 then. I don't know whether she would played the girl that was lost.
You said the surgery.
No, that was Natalie Woods, wasn't it? Natalie Woods,
yeah.
That was the girl that was snatched.
What is that, The Searchers?
Yeah.
Yeah, John
Wayne movie. She may have only had a minor part, but...
Jeffrey Hunter was in that one, too, I do believe.
Huh. Yeah, Julie Aaron
goes and plays in the Star Trek pilot, The Cage.
Hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know too much of Pippa Scott's work. I've seen her in a couple things, but not much. But she was a little over the top in this episode, but I think she was supposed to be, because she was trying to... I think the whole point was to prove to Templeton that... You don't belong here. You know, we're going to somehow push you back into the present, even if we have to be obnoxious about it. And that's what they did. I mean, she basically told them to go away, get lost.
Well, where Dave liked it, where it cuts off, they freeze and go to black. I particularly wasn't that crazy about it. I would rather they just, you know, him going out the door. And because then it does kind of give it a staged look to the episode where, you know, everybody freezes, the lights go down, and that's the end of the end scene type thing.
Well, I like it, and I didn't make the reference here because I'm not sure how many people in the room would have noticed it, but it reminded me of a scene that was used in Torchwood. It was called. It was actually the Captain Jack one, where they go into this town hall and they hear music from the 1940s during the war.
Oh, I remember that one. Yeah.
And there's a scene in there with Captain Jack, and he actually meets Captain Jack in Torchwood. It's an assumed name because obviously, he's not of our time, and so he adopts this name as an adopted name. And he actually meets in this scene the real Captain Jack. And
the namesake,
he'd taken this name because this man had actually gone off on an air raid and died. So he could take his name and things over because that man didn't have a life going forward. And then there was all this part about the I hope this is not a spoiler for anybody watching Torchwood, the point is that meeting him in this, and then this is like a time zone that sort of fades in and out of existence, because when the Captain Jack of the main story goes into it, this town hall's a bit derelict, and then it suddenly comes to life and all the lights come on. And it's all happening a little bit like the very famous frightening film where you'll know the one where he hears Johnny and he chops down the door.
Oh, The Shining.
The Shining, where the hotel comes to life. Just to get back to Torchwood, there's this scene where it's all happening, and then suddenly everything seems to slow down in slow motion, and then it fades away, and suddenly the room is back to today's, you know, dusty and derelict house. So that was another thing that it reminded me of, and that's why I quite like the way they did that.
Well, also with the fading out, you notice that they're all standing there, and all of a sudden their faces become very solemn because they're looking at him as though, we had to do this. We had to do this to make you realize you need to go back.
Yeah,
so
I think this is an episode that, if you watch it more than once, you perhaps get a little bit more out of it. I'm not saying it's a classic by any means. It is a little bit lightweight. But I think when you look at some of the nuances, there is a little bit of care gone into it.
Well, I watched it quite a few times, and it took me a long time to notice when he breaks her pearls, and then a few scenes later, her pearls are back in one piece again. I never noticed that they missed that during film editing. So every now and then you watch something a few times and you do catch something new.
Yeah, you do that if it's boring you to death. Yeah.
That's right.
Well, you see, I didn't notice that because it wasn't boring me.
Yeah, so you'll next time now you'll look for that. You'll watch it. She gets up to dance when she goes and she's jumping around like a lunatic on the dance floor, and Booth grabs her and he breaks her pearls. Her pearl necklace, you know, comes apart and it's hanging just two strings. And then two scenes later, they show her and it's back in one piece again. Then when it fades out and she's standing there, it's back in one piece. They missed that during film editing.
Yeah, editing mistake. That happens.
Yep, absolutely. So, anybody else have anything to add to this?
Yes, I'm glad I don't have to watch it again.
Yeah, watch it during a marathon, don't worry.
Don't worry.
Okay, well, if nobody else has anything more to add, we will be doing our next show, I believe, Robert, the 26th. Is that 2 weeks from now?
The 26th, yes, it is.
Yes, Saturday, February 26th, we will be doing a most unusual, yes, thank you, Dave, we'll be doing a most unusual camera. Dave put it up on the chat room. Yep, that is our next one, and that will be Saturday, February 26th, same time, same place. So, if nobody else has anything else, we will end this one for today and see you again in 2 weeks. Okay, everybody?
Yep.
Okay, all right, we will see you then. Bye-bye, and have a great weekend, everybody.
Bye, everybody.